Okay, thank you for allowing me to come present my work on the black hole qubit correspondence. This is work in collaboration with Mike Duff, Deminder Dahanayake, and Laurent Boursin. Oh dear. Okay, seems to be working. So I'm going to present a bunch of mathematical correspondences that have appeared between black holes and qubits in quantum information. And so I've got about four or five bits of evidence that something interesting is going on. At the end, I might have some ideas or some speculations about what's going on, but I don't have any conclusive ideas of what's been happening here. So I'm going to start introducing a little bit of entanglement theory and talking about 2, 3, and 4 qubits, because these are going to be related to BPS black holes, and these are going to be related to extremal black holes. And so the model of black holes in which we construct, in particular for this one, there are other versions of this correspondence, but we're going to talk about the STU, the STU model. So I'll explain a bit about what that is. And then so section 3, it starts to get fun. We talk about BPS black holes and how they're related to 3 qubits. And then this section is going to seem a little bit forced in some sense, that although these two last bits are quite interesting, the first bit's going to seem a little bit artificial. And the nice thing about this bit is that we have a bona fide mathematical diffeomorphism linking the two sides. So this is more concrete. Okay, so let's start with qubits. What's a qubit? Qubit stands for quantum bit. So quantum generalization of a classical bit. Classical bit is 0 or 1. So when you code them up into quantum information, a qubit could be, for example, the polarizations of a photon or spin up, spin down in an electron. And the most important property, most important distinguishing property of a qubit from a classical bit is that you can make superpositions of them, and therefore they can become entangled, and you can use that entanglement to do interesting things. So you abstract this away, and you just call it a qubit. So you get A00, A11, and so then you could get a qtrit, which would be A22, and then you get qnits for n-dimensional quantum states. And then obviously you have more than 2 qubits together, you tensor together Hilbert spaces. So let's say there's Alice and Bob, they both have a qubit. These are their Hilbert spaces, you tensor them together, you get 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And then in an abusive notation, they write this as 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, where it's implied that the first digit corresponds to Alice and the second digit corresponds to Bob. And so any Alice and Bob wave function is going to be some vector in this Hilbert space given by 4 complex coefficients, which we write as A, A, B. So that's a two-qubit Hilbert space, 4 complex numbers, and then so forth. You can repeat the process. 3 qubits is going to have 8 complex numbers. 4 qubits is going to have 16 complex numbers. So they're simple finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So I'm going to talk about a different kind of entanglement that most people are used to: bipartite entanglement, entanglement entropy, and that kind of stuff. I'm going to talk about a different kind of entanglement called multipartite entanglement, which is altogether different than bipartite entanglement. So to motivate how I'm going to talk about that, I'm going to take you through the quantum teleportation protocol, which is quite simple, but it gives you ideas of how I'm going to talk about entanglement. So teleportation protocol. 3 qubits, this is going to be Alice's qubit, this is going to be Bob's qubit, and here's some mystery qubit, psi alpha 0 plus beta 1, and the game is you want to teleport this one down to here. So Alice has got it in some black box and she can't see what it is.
Teleport means Q2 will become equal to Q0.
Q2 will become equal to Q0, that's right. So we start here, so I'll take you through the process. This is called the quantum circuit diagram. So psi 0, start here, 3 separable states. Alice is 0, Bob is 0, and here's this mystery state. Then, this is called the Hadamard matrix, and it's just given by 1, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And so it converts the 0 to 0 plus 1, as you can see here. So then we go through these next two gates. So this one here, these are called C knots, and they're entangling gates. And so the point is, you control on the first qubit, and if the first qubit is 1, you flip the second one. So here psi 1 is, I've just come out of the Hadamard, I'm here. So going from here to here, I flip, so that 0, 0 stays a 0, 0, and then 1, 0 flips to 1, 1. So it's an entangling operation, it's non-local. The point is, these two are now an EPR pair. So that's psi 2. Then the next step, so we're going to go through one of these, so you entangle the mystery state with Alice's qubit. So you go from here to here, so multiply it out. And so if the mystery state is a 0, you don't do anything to Alice. If the mystery state is a 1, you flip Alice's qubit. So this stays the same going from here to here. And going from here to here, you flip Alice's qubit, just like that. So then going from here to here, you use the Hadamard matrix, this one here, it's like a 45-degree rotation, on the mystery state, so 0 becomes 0 plus 1, and 1 becomes, that should be 0 minus 1. And then you multiply it all out. And then, so these are two measurement boxes, so you measure them. Alice measures her mystery state and the state she already has, and so she can either get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. And depending on what information she gets, she can then pass that information over to Bob. You can use two simple transformations to convert. Either this is psi, or these two can be easily converted back to the mystery state. So what have we done? So the point is, we've taken some quantum information, if you will, moved it around the room. And so this is a perfect process, but in general, it's not perfect. These gates are not going to be perfect gates. And so the EPR state you make here, this one here, isn't going to be a perfect EPR state. So there's only going to be a probability of success. So there's going to be some probability that you're going to succeed in teleporting the state, and some probability that you're not going to teleport the state. And we're going to define entanglement by joining up all those states that can do this process and those that can't. So what are the important points? So we've successfully transferred some quantum information. We've consumed some entanglement. So that's another important point. So you start from three qubits out here. So these double lines, these are called classical C bits. You start from three qubits, you end up with one qubit and two bits of information. So the idea is you consume some entangled state. But importantly for us, there's going to be the EPR state that's created when you entangle them is only going to be, it's not going to be perfect. In reality, it will never be perfect. So there's going to be some probability associated with achieving this protocol. So that's, when I come to talk about entanglement measures, the probability stuff will become important. So what are the heuristic properties that we've got going here? Entanglement somehow global describes some kind of something that exists across Alice and Bob. You can measure it, you can talk about, one way measuring it is talking about what tasks can be achieved in this case, teleportation, and it's consumed. So there's this idea of it's a resource. So in general, when you talk about entanglement measures, there's two kinds. There's the ones that the experimentalists use and the ones that the theoreticians use. And the two are quite different. And in fact, this is a major issue. Experimentalists have a hard time measuring entanglement the way theorists want it to happen. So anyway, we're going to look at one of these abstract measures. And the reason I told you about all this stuff is because it's going to allow us to bring group theory in to talk about our entanglement. So we're going to say psi and phi. So let's say psi were states that we're going to go into our teleportation protocol for Alice and Bob. And we're going to say that those two states are in the same entanglement class if they have the same non-zero probability of achieving the teleportation. Some non-zero probability of achieving the teleportation. And what that means is that there's some experiment you can do, which is which has some non-zero probability of converting psi to phi. It doesn't have to be happen every time. You don't have to succeed every time in converting psi to phi, as long as there's some non-zero probability. Then in the acting on the coefficients of the wave function, you're just asking for any kind of reversible operation, which gives you the GL2 to the n factorization for the group. There's an overall complex constant which is unobservable, so your group of entanglement description operations is going to be SL2 to the n. And so that's called the slot group. And when we convert to black holes, this is going to be the group that acts on the moduli space. So here, this is the SLOCC group. When we talk about black holes, this is going to be the u-duality group. So indeed, psi, the wave function coefficients, transforms the fundamental tensor of this group. And two states are related if you can, we say two states have the same entanglement from the point of view of SLOCC, if there's some SL2 to the N transformation that converts one to the other. So that's the protocol, that's the group that we're going to use to describe entanglement. Let's talk about 2, 3, and 4 qubits and how we find out whether they're entangled or not. So 2 qubits is 4 complex numbers. AAB transforms in the 2, 2 of SL2A cross SL2B, where A and B is Alice and Bob. So the obvious invariant is to treat this as a matrix, take the determinant, and then the determinant is going to be a invariant under SL2 transformations happening on the AAB. And then this is the invariant, and then you can make an entanglement measure for normalized states, which varies between 0 and 1, and is real, given by 4 times the square of the determinant. And if you were to talk about entanglement entropy, then this is actually equal to the entanglement entropy. So for bipartite systems, it's the same answer as if you were talking about entanglement entropy. So nothing's different here. And then you can talk about state reserve entangled and non-entangled, and you're led to the entangled states for EPR pairs. So everything works quite simply for 2 qubits, and in fact for any bipartite system, it's generally quite easy to solve it. But obviously for 3 qubits, things are a bit different. So you can't treat this as some kind of matrix. It's a 2, 2, 2 tensor. You can't diagonalize it, so you're going to look for invariants. SL2C cubed invariants. So this is going to be important. These are all complex numbers. When we start talking about black holes, we're going to have the issue that these are all going to be real numbers. So the first important invariant is this det AABC. So det has a capital D to signify it's a hyperdeterminant. So if AAB was a matrix, a 2x2 matrix, then you can say AABC is a 2x2x2 hypermatrix. And so this det is the generalization of the determinant to that kind of matrix. So it's the first fourth order SL2 cubed invariant. So it's the 2, 2, 2 to the fourth equals 1, 1, 1 ... So it's the first SL2 cubed invariant, and then that's going to be one of our entanglement measures, and then we get these 3 covariants. Which transform into 3, 1, 1, the 1, 3, 1, and the 1, 1, 3 of this SL2C cubed group. So out of these, you can build 4 entanglement measures. Tau ABC, and I'm going to describe these on the next slide. Tau ABC, Tau AB, Tau AC, and Tau BC. So what are these? So Tau AB, Tau BC, and Tau AC, these are these bipartite measures. So they refer to entanglement between any pair in the 3-qubit system. And this tau ABC is a new guy, and he measures multipartite entanglement, so any kind of entanglement that exists between the 3 of them. So if I was to take this state and trace out Bob, then I'm left with a maximally mixed state, so no quantum information or classical information. Whereas if I was to take this state and trace out Bob, I've still got some quantum correlations between Alice and Charlie. And so these are like entanglement entropies. And this is not. This is something else. And in fact, when we talk about black holes, these are going to be large black holes, and these are going to be small black holes. So bipartite, tripartite, so what? And the point is, tripartite or multipartite entanglement is quite different to the bipartite variety. So you've all heard of the EPR paradox and the Bell inequalities. So for the Bell inequalities, it's a statistical result, right? So you have to repeat, you have to come up with some experiment, and then after you've averaged it over a certain number of after you've averaged the result over a certain number of experiments, you find that the Bell inequality is violated, and you conclude that the world is not locally realistic. Now, you can do another experiment, and I'm not going to go through with it because it's complicated, but you can do another experiment using that tripartite state I talked about, this state here versus this state. So this is called the GHZ state, and this is called the W state. You can do another experiment where, given the rules of the experiment and what you know for how it should work, you just need one run to prove that the world is not locally realistic. You turn the experiment on, you put a GHZ state in, you look at the results, and you conclude instantly that the world is not locally realistic. It's not a statistical result. The point being, why am I showing you this? The point being that multipartite entanglement is different to bipartite entanglement. Here's an example why. And in fact, if you go into more and more multipartite entanglements, there's more and more crazy things you can do. So here's your space of 3 qubits. And by turning on these invariants, being zero and non-zero, you get a classification of 3 qubits. So you get completely separable. It's better on the next slide. Completely separable. Some bipartite relations, completely non-separable, and then non-separable plus tripartite relations. And when we come to talk about black holes, these are going to be small black holes, half supersymmetric, small black holes, 2 charge, half supersymmetric, small black holes, 3 charge, half supersymmetric, quarter supersymmetric, and these are going to be large black holes, 4 charges, 1/8 supersymmetric. And so these diagrams and these lines that I've pointed to correspond to turning these invariants on and off. And here they're representatives. You get separable, 3 biseparables, 1 W state, and then this GHZ state here, which is sometimes also known as it's SL2Q related to the cat state, sometimes called the cat state. Okay? So that's all good. So you've done a 2-qubit classification where states can be entangled and not entangled. You've done a 3-qubit classification when you found all this. And then the problem is when you get to 4 qubits, it's a completely different kettle of fish again. So now the entanglement group is SL2C to the fourth. So there's 4 times 3 equals 12 complex parameters. Psi A, B, C, D, the coefficients of the state, you've got 16 complex parameters. So now you're left with a space of cosets, which describe your overall possibilities of entanglement. And it's different from 3 qubits because for 3 qubits, there was just a discrete number. Now there's an infinite number parameterized by some numbers. So we need some new techniques, we need some new methods to solve the 4-qubit problem, and the 5-qubit problem isn't solved. So what do you do? And what we're going to do, and it seems a bit artificial, so we're going to rely on this, there's this Lie algebra isomorphism, SO4C is equal to SL2C, so we're going to convert 2 of the SL2s, or the 4 SL2s into SO4 cross SO4, and then I'm going to show you how the problem of classifying 4 qubits, or looking at the entanglement of 4 qubits, is given by the nilpotent orbits classification of SO8C. Seems a bit complicated. I'll explain a bit in a minute. But these nilpotent orbits are going to become important because when we talk about black holes, we'll find that the condition for extremal black holes in 4 dimensions is going to correspond to some nilpotent orbits on the moduli space. So what's a nilpotent orbit? So given a group G, and it's Lie algebra, well, I should call that H, G and H, there's the adjoint action of G on H, and so that's the Bogstad adjoint action. If H is an element of the Lie algebra such that it's nilpotent, there is some n such that H to the n is zero, then these are called nilpotent conjugacy classes, nilpotent adjoint orbits, or just nilpotent orbits. And the point is that if your orbits, all your orbits was like a book, then the nilpotent orbits form like the chapters of the book or the structure of the whole book, and the semi-simple orbits are a bit like the text. It's a bad example, but the point is the nilpotent orbits sort of provide all the structure for everything else, and all the semi-simple orbits fit within the nilpotent orbits. So SL2C cross SL3C is SO4C. So you use that, this homomorphism, to convert psi ABCD into from a 2, 2, 2, 2 to a 4, 4 of SO4C. So you take this R, 4, 4, and you construct this R tilde, which is anti-symmetric, R minus RT. Seems a bit artificial, but the point is, this is a Lie algebra element of SO8C, and then looking at the action of the subgroup SO4 cross SO4 of SO8C on these elements, you can talk about nilpotent orbits and it makes sense. So the condition for nilpotent orbits means you want this R here, so this guy here, this 4, 4, this matrix that you constructed, to be nilpotent. So if it's not nilpotent, you're left with the bog standard semi-simple orbits. But if it is nilpotent, then you're talking about nilpotent orbits. Lots of dry maths. Why do I tell you about this? Well, because it's going to be related to the extremal black holes. And the other reason, so for 4 qubits, the reason you would want to use this as opposed to the regular classification is that if you open up your book on nilpotent orbits, you find that there's only ever a finite number of them. So now you've got a finite classification of 4 qubits, and everything's going to fit into one of these. All the semi-simple orbits are going to correspond to at least one of these. So you get so as before, separable, biseparable, there's the W state, and the GHZ state is, here it is, right here. So there's other states now, which are four-way entangled, but I can't draw pretty pictures for what they look like, because it's not clear what they are. But at least you've got a classification. And these are all going to correspond to different black holes, right? Extremal, BPS, different fractions of BPS, things like that. So, told you about qubits. Now I'm going to tell you about, so keep that in mind for when we come back to this. I'm going to tell you about the STU model, which is the supergravity model, super string theory model we're going to use to make these black holes. So the important information is n equals 2 supergravity in 4 dimensions coupled to 3-vector multiplets. So there's 4 vector fields, one from the gravity photon. There are many ways to realize it, but the way we're going to use it is type 2A string theory on a T6, on a 6-dimensional torus, and we're going to factor it into 3 T2s, and these are going to correspond to 3 qubits, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. So, and we're going to put some D0s, some D2s, some D4s, and D6s. And so we're going to make static, spherically symmetric ansatz. So we're going to talk about static black holes. And because of this, because of the 4 vector fields, our solution is going to be parameterized by 4 or 8 charges, 4 electric and 4 magnetic. And so the important point about why you might be interested in this STU model, or why we were interested in the STU model, is that the duality group is SL2R cubed. And this SL2R cubed is what we're going to convert to the SL2C for the qubits, for 3 qubits in this case. An aside on the STU model, why are you interested in it in general? So lots of people are interested in it because the So the supersymmetry equations force the moduli space to be special Kähler. There's a nice interaction with the attractor mechanism. You can solve the entropy. It's easily embedded into almost any n equals 8 model. But for us, we can relate it to 3 qubits, and that's why we're going to look at it. And then afterwards, we're related to 4 qubits. So you make your spherically symmetric ansatz. You put it into your action. You end up, you find that the gravity decouples, and you end up with this one-dimensional motion in a potential, where this potential is given by these mu's and nu's in the field strengths. And then just looking for, regularity on the boundary tells you that the area is given by the potential. And so if you put the numbers in, you end up with S, the entropy, is given by pi times this function, dpq, where dpq is this complicated function. There are manifestly better symmetric ways to look at it. This is not the most obviously symmetric way to see it. However, this way is obviously related to 3 qubits. So these are the 8 charges. This is for extremal black holes. These are the 8, so P1, P2, P3, P4, Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. Those are the 8 charges of the black hole. This function is SL2R cubed invariant. And in particular, it's triality invariant under swapping the magnetic charges and swapping the electric charges. And that's going to correspond to swapping Alice, Bob, and Charlie on the QI side. Okay, so that was just briefly about the STU model. Now we start with the fun stuff. So remember 3 qubits, 8 complex numbers. A tripartite entanglement is given by this hyperdeterminant. So you have 8 charges and 8 complex coefficients. And if you assign them to each other in this fashion, then you find that that complicated black hole entropy function I gave you earlier, this guy, is actually equal to minus the hyperdeterminant of the wave function coefficients. So then you can say the entropy of the black hole is given by the tripartite entanglement of 3 qubits. Now, the result seems a little bit artificial. First of all, part of the problem is these are complex numbers, and in the string theory limit, these are integers. In supergravity, you can take them as real. So there's an issue there. You might also say, well, hang on a minute. These are SL2 cubed C invariant. This is SL2R invariant. Obviously, if you take two groups that are similar, map up the fundamental representations, mapping up the invariants is quite trivial. You're not really saying anything that strong. And so if I would have presented this work about a year and a half ago, I would say that was probably a valid criticism. But given what I'm going to show you afterwards, which isn't so much related to the group theory, then you can come back and look at this result and try and give it some stronger meaning if it's not from the group theory. The other issue is these are real, these are complex, and these are real. So when I used to present this work, I would say there is such a thing as a real qubit. Where these numbers are real. And for 3 qubits, you can show, it's not too hard, you can show that for any qubit state, you can convert it to a basis using your SL2 cubed or SU2 cubed transformations to where these are real. And it's different to real, I'm not making a statement about real quantum mechanics, I'm just making a statement about 3 qubits. And the point is, for almost all states, and in fact all states except for the GHZ can be converted into real numbers, and then if you restrict to the real space, then your group falls down to SL2R cubed, and then you feel better about doing this. However, in the second half of the talk, when I talk about extremal black holes and 4 qubits, there's a bona fide diffeomorphic map from the reals to the complexes. So hopefully, and since this should embed into that, this problem should be fixed. Okay. So given that, and given this, okay, if I was to construct my black hole out of D-brains using this map, then I find this nice dictionary. So 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, these are the, this is the compactified torus. And here are the charges, and here's the dictionary converting the charges to the wave function coefficients using our dictionary. Then you find, interestingly, so this is a D0 brain, corresponds to the 0, 0, 0. This is a D4 brain, corresponds to the 1, 1, 0. Here's another D4 brain with crosses in the second, the last, the bottom four tori, and it's got the 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. The D6 brain corresponds to the 1, 1, 1. So there's a nice correspondence between where the D brains are located and where the kets are located. And what the kets, what kets are turned on and what kets are turned off. Okay, so you make your black holes. What's the next question you can do? Classify them. One charge, two charge, three charge, four charge, half supersymmetric, quarter supersymmetric, one eighth supersymmetric. And so for the supersymmetry conditions, there's these rules. The rules that determine whether a black hole is half supersymmetric, quarter supersymmetric, or any intersection of orthogonal brains. And so here I've got a D4 brain intersecting a D0 brain. And the point is, so you get these two different types of directions, right? You get relatively transverse directions and overall transverse directions. And the, from the string theory boundary condition, open string theory boundary conditions and BPS conditions, the only requirement, or the most important requirement, is that there is four relatively transverse directions. So you can put, you can do T dualities wherever you want, but this will always be, this, there's always going to be four of these. And that's the key point. So let's apply those conditions. Let's build up some black holes. So one charge, half supersymmetric, one D0 brain. And if you use your dictionary, you find that's completely the separable state. Next one is two charge, one quarter supersymmetric. So now you've got a D0, add a D4, you get this quantum state, and it corresponds to one of the bipartite entangled states. There's three ways you can do this on the black hole side, and that gives you the three ways you can get the bipartite entanglement of three qubits. Add another D-brain, so now you've got four D-brains. This is one quarter supersymmetric, and the only way you can do that gives you exactly the quantum state that's got three binary relationships. Add another D-brain for the four charged black hole, which is 1/8 supersymmetric, and you get, using the dictionary, you find you get exactly the GHZ state, or the tripartite entangled state. So indeed, you find that the classification of three qubits exactly matches the classification of black holes, of STU black holes. And that's not exactly due to the group theory on the black hole side. Now, interestingly, so one charge, two charge, three charge, four charge, five charge black hole is a generating solution. And on the black hole side, or on the string theory side, the fifth charge is an NS charge. And we couldn't really find a way to deal with that apart from if you make three T dualities along some of the torus conditions and convert it to a type 2B theory, then you only get D3 brains intersecting in, according to this table. And if you allow one of the D3 brains to intersect at an angle, it gets a fifth charge and it works out as a generating solution. So you generate, so you get N0, N1, N2 D3 brains, and you take this N3 D brain, and then you let it intersect at an angle, it generates some more D3 brains. But the point is, from this solution, you can use your moduli space equations, group theory, to generate any other solution you want. And interestingly, the corresponding quantum information state also happens to be a generating solution in the sense that this state can be mapped to any other state using SU2 cube transformations. Okay, so that's the DPS black hole 3-qubit correspondence. That maybe seems a little bit contrived because I've done this funny mapping from charges from black hole charges to wave function coefficients. Here, it's going to work perfectly though. So, and the way it's going to work is this thing called the Kostan Sakiguchi correspondence for nilpotent orbits, and it's going to directly map the problem in 4-qubit space to the problem on the black holes, which is the extremal classification of black holes in the SDU model. So the way you do that, let's see what we're doing. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to do a time-like reduction. So we're going to take the SDU model, we're going to reduce it on the time coordinate. So the only way you can do that, you have to have a globally defined time-like Killing vector. And for static spherically symmetric solutions, this is okay. So in D equals 4, like I said earlier, the moduli space is SL2 cubed over SO2 cubed, and the 8 charges transform as the 2, 2, 2. So you compactify down to D equals 3. Your three-dimensional duality group is SO4, 4, and the moduli space is SO4, 4 divided by SO2, 2 cross SO2, 2. So if I was to do the canonical compactification to D equals 3 on a space dimension rather than a time dimension, this would be SO4 cross SO4 underneath. So flipping the time coordinate, flipping to a time-like compactification changes the original M3 to an M3 star, which is a metric indefinite signature version of the M3. So the nice thing about D equals 3 dimensions is that all vectors are dual to scalars. So you can dualize all your vectors, and your entire theory moves into your moduli space. And in particular, I'll tell you about that in the next slide. If you make the static spherically symmetric ansatz, you find the gravity part of the theory decouples, and you're just left with motion on the moduli space. So you just got a parameterized geodesics on the moduli space. And so what's the point? Why would you do that? So one of the most important points is that the GTT component of the metric moves into the moduli space. So by making regularity statements on your moduli space or making regularity statements on the geodesics on the moduli space, you're making statements of regularity in the original four-dimensional theory. So you've taken this to the next slide, I think. I'll come back to that in a minute. So the point is, you get a new tool with which to study GCT component. So you can use your differential geometry and your group theory techniques and so convert the line element, ds squared is gamma I, d phi I, d phi j, into trace dm, dn to the minus 1, where m are these symmetric matrices built out of coset representatives. And so most people do this. I'll talk about it. So you get this coset space structure. So the action is given by geodesic motion in this moduli space, where gamma ij is the metric on the moduli space. You can rewrite it in this matrix form. And then you'd get led to this equation, m to the minus 1, d tau m is q. So q is a matrix of Noether charges along this geodesic motion in this moduli space. And the condition for extremality is going to mean that q is going to be it has to be nilpotent. And so q is going to want to map to the quantum information charges. So m is this. M is this coset lives in the coset space. Q is a matrix of Noether charges. So each of the q tau makes sense. So let's say m zero was the Schrodinger equation, the initial state for the Schrodinger equation. Then you could write some transformation that would maybe transform it into a Reichstein-Nordström black hole, something like that. So what is this Q? This Q is going to become important. So if you look at the group decompositions, so these, so we're living in the SO4, so we're living, M is SO4, 4 divided by SO2, 2 coset space structure. So if you look at the decomposition, SO4, 4 goes to two SO2, 2s plus a 4, 4. So given that M is in the coset space, it stands to reason that Q is as 4, 4. Or if you convert these to SL2s, Q is as 2, 2, 2, 2, which is going to be what the quantum information states are. So like I said, gravity decouples. You get some nice solutions. And then you get this geodesic constraint, right? So along the geodesics, you get this constant parameter. Now, just like in Lorentz space or regular space, geodesics on indefinite metric, on a manifold with indefinite metric, this can be positive, negative, or zero. I'll talk about it in the next slide. But this is where this one-dimensional motion in the moduli space equation comes from that I showed you earlier. So geodesics can be positive, negative, or zero. So just to give you an idea, if instead of doing the HTU model, I was doing regular Einstein-Maxwell, then you find that C squared is M squared minus Q squared, where Q squared is the charge on the black hole. So C squared is the extremality parameter. So for positive solutions, it's the regular Rice-Nordstrom black hole. Negative solutions are singular. And then C squared equals zero solutions are the extremal solutions. And then if you put the numbers in for these extremal solutions, you find that there's a condition that this Q matrix has to be nilpotent. So let's say you have your Schrodinger, you want to generate a new solution to Einstein-Maxwell. You have your Schrodinger equation. You can work out what the corresponding M is. You can do a G transformation, one of these SO4, 4 moduli space transformations, to make a new solution, perhaps a charged one or something like that. So for Q, for extremal solutions, Q cubed is nilpotent. So you can expand this, and you get this G, 1, Q, tau, Q squared, tau squared. So now, your problem of looking at solutions and classifying your orbit space on this moduli, on this indefinite moduli, so these are now conjugacy classes, G, G to the minus 1, of nilpotent elements in here. So the problem is now, problem of classifying extremal solutions, you're now looking at SO4, 4, nilpotent orbits of SO4, 4. And this is where this constant Sukiguchi correspondence comes in. Oh, so before I talk about that, let me tell you about the black hole solutions. So you go to your favorite book on nilpotent orbits, you look up the SO4, 4 orbits, and it tells you, lo and behold, there's 31. And you nicely get to reproduce all the solutions you knew already in the four-dimensional case. So these here, these are the small black holes. This one here is the large black hole. So you get 1/2 BPS with all the different conditions that you had on the central charges. 1/2 BPS, non-BPS, 1/2 BPS, 3 non-BPS, and then another 1/2 BPS. These are all the small ones. And light-like critical, doubly critical, corresponds to conditions on the entropy and the differential of the first and second differential of the entropy, or the invariant, and then you get large black hole solutions. And so this 31 here, you can map, so it's easier to count the orbits on the real, on the black hole side, because they're real orbits. You can map this over to 4 qubits, and the claim is there's 31 ways of classifying 4 qubits. So that's the claim anyway. So this constant Sukiguchi correspondence that I've been telling you about for the whole seminar goes like this. So you start with this convex group, SO8C. You look at a non-compact real form, SO4, 4, and then a non-compact subgroup of this, SO2, 2 plus SO2, 2. This gives you a corresponding Cartan decomposition on the complex side. So you're looking for SO8C goes to SO4 twice plus a 4, 4. So to get this Cartan decomposition corresponds to this on the complexified side. And so the Kostan-Sekiguchi correspondence tells you that orbits of SO4, 4 are nilpotent Q inside this Lie algebra, which I showed you before was this 2, 2, are diffeomorphic to SL2 to the 4 orbits on the 2, 2, 2C. So this guy, orbits, nilpotent orbits of this guy on its Lie algebra are diffeomorphic to nilpotent orbits of this guy on this guy, which for us corresponds to SL2 to the 4 on the 2, 2, 2. So, and this guy is the extremal classification of black holes, and this guy is the entanglement classification of 4 qubits. So using this nice correspondence, you've directly mapped the problem of what's an extremal black hole in 4 dimensions in the STU model to what's the entangled states of 3 qubits. And so the overall thing is, you start from extremal black holes, you end up with real nilpotent orbits of SO4, 4, and then your Ks constant Sekiguchi correspondence tells you the complex nilpotent orbits of SL2 to the 4, and then this gives you a 4-qubit entanglement classification. And so now you can match up the black holes to the qubits, and you find, so there are nine of them altogether. So here's the separable, this one's biseparable, this is the W state, there's the GHZ state, this guy and this guy are some four-way entangled states, and you can map them to the corresponding black holes. And so it's not on this diagram here, but there's a whole bunch of orbits behind every single one of these, and they're all diffeomorphic. And then there's these three. So the new result, one of the new results from the work that was done for the nilpotent orbit classification of 4 qubits, black holes, sorry, is they found these new extremal black holes, which are not smooth limits of non-extremal black holes. And so these have the corresponding 4-qubit structure. So where can you go next with all this? So obviously these are the nilpotent orbits. And on the black hole side, nilpotent orbits corresponds to extremal. So if you relax the nilpotent condition, you're going to live with semi-simple orbits, and that's going to correspond to non-extremal black holes. The nice thing is, on this side, we already know what the answer is for the semi-simple orbits. So we already know what the answer is for the 4 qubits. So if we can show that the orbit structure works for the semi-simple orbits as well, and it seems like it should, given the fact that, like I was telling you before, nilpotent orbits provide the structure to the overall orbit theory, and most semi-simple orbits just fill in the space in between the nilpotent orbits. So it seems likely that, in fact, we can map the non-extremal black holes to the 4 qubits as well, although we haven't done that yet. Another thing to do, there's all this work by Larsen et al. On they've been developing a constituent model for non-BPS black holes, where they've got valid orthogonal deep brain intersections that map to non-BPS states. And so it would be interesting to see if that dictionary I showed you before, where the 000 state corresponds to a D0 brain and the 100 state corresponds to a D2 brain, it would be interesting to see if that also works for a non-BPS side, because that would be a non-trivial test of what's going on here. And I already know it does work. So this is a non-BPS D0, D6 state, which maps to the correct qubit size. So there's already one example where it does work. And then, although we haven't done the work yet, the group theory should work. The group theory numbers work out fine, that there is the bona fide N equals 8 generalization of this constant Sekiguchi correspondence. So I just told you about one particular aspect of this black hole qubit correspondence. In fact, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I've been working on as well. So I've been talking about 3 qubits and BPS black holes in STU model. In fact, there's a 2-qutrit, 5-dimensional M-theory black hole correspondence where you take 11-dimensional supergravity, compactify on a 6 torus again, split your six torus into three tori, and then a Q trait is going to correspond to, so zero is going to correspond to, so you get a similar map from, and that's going to be one of the three toruses, and I'm going to be talking about M2 brains. So there's a whole other column here where you can put another one in, get two Q traits and M2 brains. And then you find the groups match as well. You find the entanglement of the two Q traits also is given by the entropy. So that's all quite nice. And then there's the N equals 8 generalization, which corresponds to embedding the STU model and the qubits into higher dimensions. So on the black hole side, you embed the N equals 2 model into the N equals 8 model, and you get 56 charges. And in this case, you can talk about, so you do the decomposition of E7 under SL2, and you find that you can fit 7 qubits in this state. And I4, which is the Cartan invariant for the E7 invariant for black holes in the N equals 8 theory, then the conjecture is this gives some measure entanglement for this particular funny tripartite entanglement of 7 qubits.
But E4 is not quantized.
No, it's not quantized. And so that's other aspects of the theoretical side, or the correspondence. And so there's also been, so let's say everything I've told you today is indeed a pure coincidence and there's no physics behind it at all. Then it still allows you to move mathematics from one side to the other and talk about old problems with new ways. And in fact, so we have managed to do is calculate the coset space structure for the 3-qubit entanglement. And we've got this, we did this generalization of superqubits. So inspired by some work on the Nambu-Goto action in N equals, in 2,2 target space signature, there was this supersymmetric structure, and we were able to show that if you were to generalize qubits from, so you can say that at 1 qubit, A0, 0 plus A1, 1 is like a 2 of SL2C, sorry. Then, so you could say a superqubit is A0, 0 plus A1, 1 plus, so we called it Brill, some fermionic sum there. So this is now a 3 of OSP1/2. So that was quite fun. We got to do a whole generalization of qubits to a supersymmetric space, inspired by some of the mathematics on the black hole side. So anyway, the number one question people give me when I give this talk is, what's going on? Is there any physics? What's going on here? Now, I don't have a good answer for you, but I have some speculation. So the near horizon geometry of these black holes is ADS2 cross S2. So any particular ADS-CFT that's going to work is going to be CFT1, which is going to be superconformal quantum mechanics. Also, this black hole qubit correspondence only works in the large charge limit. So you can talk about large charges in the same way you would talk about in ADS-CFT. Now, there's a paper from Sen in 2008, because he's been doing a lot of work on ADS2, CFT1, and he concludes that, in fact, the superconformal quantum mechanics in CFT1 is altogether quite different to the canonical superconformal quantum mechanics, and in fact has a finite dimensional Hilbert space given by the electromagnetic charges on the black hole, which is in fact exactly what we have here for the black hole qubit correspondence. And then Strominger and friends, they looked at some entropy functions in ADS2, CFT1, and they also found the correct formula for the entropy on the superconformal quantum mechanics side. Some people talked about black fuzzballs in the sense that, there's this idea of coarse graining on the phase space, and then you end up with a much smaller number of degrees of freedom than you started with. And so Vijay Balasubramanian was telling me that perhaps this is an idea. If you quantize your fuzzball phase space structure and then do this coarse graining, it stands to reason you might end up with a really simple Hilbert space structure, which is like 3 or 4 qubits. So given all that, so remember when I told you at the beginning, perhaps the weakest one is this, S is, you're just mapping invariants on one side of the theory, one's with SLTC and one's with SL2R. So given all everything else I've told you, then you can go back and look at this and go, okay, well maybe there is something to this result. Then you can make conjectures about, because on the quantum informationists stop talking about entropy when they talk about more than bipartite entanglement. In fact, when they go to multipartite entanglement, the link to entropy is not quite as clear. So if you take this seriously, there's a suggestion that tripartite entanglement for these particular black holes is relevant. And so in this case, it's a bit like saying your brains, your D brains that construct your black hole, are in some way entangled. So, I mean, it's a nebulous, fuzzy concept, but that's what perhaps that's suggesting. Also, it's suggesting that there is multipartite entanglement might actually be linked to entropy in the end, which is something new from the quantum informationist side. So, anyway, a lot of stuff to talk about, but let me just conclude by saying, so let me just run through what we got again. So black hole entropy is given by 3-qubit hyperdeterminant or tripartite entanglement of 3 qubits. All the BPS configurations of the black holes exactly match the entanglement configurations for 3 qubits. So you get 1D brain, 1 charged black hole, separable state, 3D brains, 1 quarter supersymmetric, that should be 2 charged black hole, is the 3 times the biseparable state. 3 charge, 3 brain, D brains, is 1 quarter supersymmetric, that gives you the non-separable W state. And then 4 charges, 1 out supersymmetric, gives you the tripartite, the maximally entangled 3-qubit state. And indeed, both sides have a 5-parameter generating solution, but for different reasons. And then you get this nice thing where using this constant Sakaguchi correspondence and a whole bunch of complicated group theory on nilpotent orbits, you can map exactly the classification of 4 qubits into exactly the problem of working out what's an extremal black hole in 4 dimensions. So, interesting stuff. I haven't given you a really good reason why everything is working like the way it is, but it does seem to be working. So I hope, hopefully I've intrigued you a little bit. Thank you.
Wave functions, one to one, like also, just a classification of wave functions to classification of black
holes. I mean, what about the normalization of the wave function? So this is an issue, right? So there's two ways out of that. I mean, because I'm talking about SL2 cubed on the quantum information side. The normalization is not invariant under that. So the normalization no longer becomes important on the QI side. And so in fact, talking about these, you can only talk about, the way I talk about entanglement this way, you can only talk about that if the states are normalized. Because if you make an SL2 transformation on a qubit, if you make an SL2 transformation on this, it's not going to be normalized anymore. So you can't talk about normalization. So then there's another problem. Okay, so you're not talking about normalized states. Then there's a problem. In principle, entropy is measurable, right? From a reserve at sitting at infinity, adding up all the stuff. Whereas the normalization of tau is not, in principle, measurable in the sense that... So let's say I was talking about normalized states, then this function varies between 0 and 1. Luckily, I'm talking about SL2 transformations, so normalization doesn't make any sense anyway. So this number is not bounded from above, so I can set it to whatever I want. But then that's the problem. I can set it to whatever I want. There's no observable way to set it to where it needs to be. And so that is a bit of an issue. But I mean, so the one way around that is to say, because there's a proper map from the charges to the wave function coefficients, it's quite easy to go from entropy to entanglement entropy. It's quite easy to go from black holes to qubits, because in the process of doing that, by assigning the charges to the coefficients, you fix the overall normalization. Going back, you don't have that. So it's more complicated to go the other way. So indeed, that is an issue, but it's only half of an issue in the sense that you can, it works fine going from black holes to qubits, but it becomes an issue when you go the other way.
There's some conjecture as to what the most general possible, you know, what's the best possible thing that could happen in terms of, I would want to somehow think of this as qubit math somehow classifying black holes.
You can think of it that way. I mean, so the guys that, so Pioline and Bergsdorf and et al., who first looked at near perfect orbits to study extremal black holes. And so, in fact, they're looking at the SO4,4 on the nilpotent 28th. But if you look into the math of nilpotent orbits, it's quite complicated, and the real orbits are completely unknown. And so if you read their paper, most of what they do is they take this, and they use this correspondence and map the problem to the complex side and start, even though they didn't realize they were talking about qubits, they were actually looking at it from the qubit side. So the answer comes from looking at the qubit side anyway. To get you the right answer for the slight complication. I'm being a little bit. So there's number 9 here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, which is the number of orbits up to permutation, comes from looking at the complex sides. And then this number 31 comes from looking at the real side. And that number 31 is the 9 not including permutations. So the two numbers, so the permutations are easy to count on the real side, and not including the permutations, easy to count on the complex side. So we were able to make this conjecture that there's 31 orbits, 31 entanglement orbits of 4 qubits on the quantum information side, not up to permutations. So in this case, there's an explicit example of using mass from one to talk about statements in the other. And this was the one we got a bit of press recently, because people are criticizing us, and all we were saying is that you can use string theory to tell you about qubits, and in fact the claim is there are 31 orbits, which are quite easy to see on the real side, but hard to see on the complex side, and therefore you can make a statement that there are 31 entangled, four-way entangled states on the 4-qubit side.
Thank you.